You're listening to Innovation for Alpha, where we explore everything at the intersection of healthcare innovation and finance. Through our discussions and interviews, we keep you informed and educated about healthcare innovations, next-level venture investing, and everything involving the combination of the two.
Hello, everybody. This is Tobin Arthur with the Innovation for Alpha podcast, and I'm really excited here on a weekend. I love weekend podcasts. They're a little more relaxing and fun, and I've got a very interesting team behind a startup called Embrace Preventive Care that I want to introduce to you. We're going to start off by talking about a couple of the leaders behind the company and talk a little bit about where this space is going. It's a very interesting space, and they are well positioned to do some interesting things. So David Dulesk is the CEO of the company, and I welcome you, David, and Dr. Heder Varech. I'm still butchering his name. I'm working on it, but I welcome you both. And why don't we start off, David, just introduce yourself and tell a little bit about your background, and then Heder will do the same with you.
Great. Well, thank you so much for being here. I've been in the healthcare space all my career, getting on to be 40 plus years now. And it's been with large companies like Baxter Healthcare, where I sort of cut my teeth and learned all about sales and manufacturing and developing products and services to more startup companies. I was a corporate officer at Biogen, not so much when we were a startup, but when we launched our first drug. And so had a great experience of being on the stick of the hockey stick, so to speak. But I've also done very early stage startups, and none of which are household names, partly because I was always a little bit too far ahead of the curve. I did my first digital health startup in 1994. We actually developed a product that's still in use today for surgical planning for abdominal or aortic aneurysms. Oh. And then in early in 2000, I did a company called Recovery Pharmaceuticals, where we were focused on developing medications to treat addiction. And, you know, we had couple good products, made progress, but we were ahead of the curve and we just couldn't get the money raised at that time. Now we know how important that is and how things are moving.
I was going to say today that would be a blockbuster.
Yeah. But now I feel like we're, you know, we have, you know, the right concept, the right company at the right time, because our focus is on older adult health, and it's on prevention. And, you know, our focus is that, you know, prevention is the way to flatten the curve on the rising costs of care, and also to be able to help older adults stay independent and age in place longer, living independently the way that they want to be. And after the pandemic, you know, fewer and fewer people want to end up in, you know, in institutional living situations. So
that's great. And David, where are you based?
I'm based in the Boston area.
Okay, yours well. I was telling Heder before you got on that I was just in Boston last week. It's a love the city. This is a great time of year when the fall colors are changing, and of course it was a busy week with Tom Brady coming back to town and the Red Sox getting started in the playoffs. That was a super exciting one-day game.
They kicked Tampa Bay last night.
That's right. I didn't even put that together, that was a repeat of the two cities. That's good.
Yeah.
Dr. Varech, please pronounce your name properly for me. I'm sorry. but welcome and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Thanks, Tobin, for the invitation. My name is Heder Varech, and I'm a cardiologist and heart failure specialist. And I wear a couple of different hats. So clinically, I'm a heart failure cardiologist. I work at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, but I do most of my clinical time actually at the VA in Boston, where I am an associate director, and I have I'm an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. And my clinical work is really diverse because I get to see both how the VA works, which is a very, very different world, and it has really sort of shaped how I think about prevention and population health in general. And then I get to see how sort of a more traditional academic center, such as a hospital system like the Brigham Works. And I feel like there's a lot that I bring from my time at the VA that I think we could use, and we are, in fact, trying to use at Embrace Prevention Care as well to optimize care for older adults with serious illness. In addition, I am a fairly active researcher. I publish in the New England Journal in JAMA, and I also write a bunch. I write frequently for the New York Times, as well as the Washington Post and others. And Embrace is the first startup that I've really ever worked with in my life. And part of it was because I spoke to Dave and I felt like his mission was very patient-oriented, like the way I think. And so I think what he's trying to achieve is really something special. So I've been an advisor for Embrace most of this year.
I love it. That's an incredible background. And I can see exactly how Embrace is benefiting from all those perspectives. That's super interesting. Why don't we talk a little bit about how this company came to be? David, why don't you just give us a little bit of context and just a snapshot of where you are at the moment?
Sure. So it came about from an investment that I made as an angel investor in a medication adherence company. And ultimately, the CEO asked me to come in to consult and help, but it was the wrong technology and the wrong business model. But what I learned about medication adherence was that it's a big problem. Everyone in healthcare recognizes it. No one's responsible for solving it, and no one really wants to pay for it. And so having spent some money and some time on this, I tend to be stubborn, and I said, you know, there's got to be a way to fix this. And so what that became the genesis of Embrace is to say, look, people with many conditions, they're the ones who need adherence help the most. And so how can we provide them with additional help to be able to, you know, get over the barriers that are keeping them from being adherent? And the biotech industry, they actually do pay for adherence, because when you have an expensive biotech drug, they actually hire small companies to keep in touch with patients and make sure that they're available to take their $10,000 a month drug every month, because it pays off. You know, most of our patients are taking generic drugs, so the companies aren't going to pay for that. But what we realize is that if we can provide medication adherence services along with getting the pharmacy revenue, that can be a way to make this happen. And in providing the services to the patients to help them on the medication adherence side, you know, those are also the kinds of interactions that can get reimbursed for in chronic care management and remote patient monitoring. So the whole idea is to be able to have build a relationship with the patient, have a regular continuous contact, and focus on the things that are most important to them on a personal basis to be able to, you know, reduce the advance of their disease and be able to avoid hospitalizations.
I want to come back and tie that into the business model in just a minute. But Hayter, I want to get your perspective while we're on this topic of adherence. And so you're seeing patients in different environments, as you mentioned, the VA environment and then a more traditional system environment. Talk a little bit about first of all, talk about what your experience is. How do you see these patients in terms of adherence? How would you define the problem as a clinician from your perspective?
Yeah, the way I see it is, you know, as we've made more innovations, the work of being a patient is getting harder and harder. So if you think about, for example, just heart failure, which is the leading cause of hospital admissions in this country, at a minimum, patients are taking 3 to 4 medications that they have to take on a day-to-day basis, and that those are all evidence-based therapies. The average heart failure patient, older heart failure patient, will be on 7 or 8 medications. I mean, that's a lot of work. I mean, think about if we had to take just one of those medications and never had to forget taking them, how hard would that be? Now, add on the fact that, you know, patients are struggling with financial toxicity. They're not as mobile as they used to be. They may not have as much support as they used to have. Previous generations, we had a lot of family members living together, but a third of our heart failure patients live by themselves. Mm. So the very work of being a patient is becoming so hard that unless we provide them additional support, that we're just setting them up to fail. And in, you know, what we're doing right now is, you know, we wait for people to get sick. We wait for them to come to the hospital. We bombard them with information and new medications and all these changes. And then we send them home, and that's really about it. And then we kind of reset the clock and wait for them to fall off track again. And so there's this big gap between the intensity of care that we're providing in the inpatient side, and then a complete vacuum when folks are home kind of by themselves, and we don't really have any bridge between these two processes. So I think it's a huge problem. And really, this is a public health crisis, because we're not living in a time where we don't have treatments. Heart disease and chronic illnesses are not conditions like ALS or Alzheimer's, where we're still struggling to find the next big thing. The next big things are already here. The question is, how do we get them to our patients?
That's a great way to frame it. And, you know, maybe you can quantify, not necessarily in terms of numbers, but when you say the, you know, lack of adherence, and as you mentioned, they go home and it's difficult to follow the regimen. I think everybody can understand that. I mean, I forget to take a single, you know, vitamin C every day. So let alone, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 drugs. What's that look like then as a clinician? Are you seeing them back in the hospital, and that now it's more serious? I mean, what is that? What's the implications of that?
So I'll give you the example of heart failure alone. So for heart failure, we have 3 to 4 evidence-based therapies that we know both extend and improve the life of patients with heart failure. And in a large registry, only, and this is shocking, 1% of patients were taking all three at the appropriate doses. And we know for after heart attacks, only about half of our patients will still take their medications even within a year after a heart attack. Wow. But what we do know is that the patients who do take their medications are less likely to be back in the hospital, less likely to have another heart attack or have heart failure. So this, the price that we're paying for this gap is real. But so far we don't have a great system where, you know, clinicians are all, I mean, as a physician, if I'm in the hospital, I'm struggling to keep up with the patients in the hospital. I have no way of keeping a track of the patients I've discharged. And on the outpatient setting, I mean, physicians are running from patient to patient, where we just don't have, I mean, we just need more support to be able to maintain this, and patients need more help as well, because the price you're paying is real.
That makes sense. And I think anybody that, you know, obviously clinicians will completely resonate with the fact that they don't have time to monitor this. So, David, that ties back into how are you guys solving this? What's the goal for how this program works? And maybe walk us through an example of a patient.
Sure. So when we look at our goal, you know, if our key performance indicator, if you will, it is reducing hospitalizations. Because when we're working with complex patients, we're not going to cure them. They're older adults. You know, they're, you know, things are going downhill. We're trying to change the slope of that hill. And so the key thing is to keep avoiding preventable hospitalizations. And just for heart failure patients, for the 8 million heart failure patients, HHS estimates there are 1 million preventable heart failure hospitalizations each year. So the key thing is to be able to, you know, as Heather pointed out, is to be able to support the patients. And we do this by providing, you know, tech-enabled services. And the services are come through a nurse practitioner. So we use a nurse practitioner to work closely with the patient's primary care physician, identify what the care plan is for that patient, what the drug regimen should be. And then it's the nurse practitioner's job to help the patient implement that. And this can be done through frequent telehealth calls. It doesn't have to be video. It can just be over the phone. And, you know, and there are Medicare reimbursement codes for chronic care management and remote patient monitoring that are in place to pay for those interactions. And it's this regular building the relationship with the patient, where the nurse practitioner knows who the patient is, what they need, what their goals are. And this is what we've learned from Rob Schreiber, our geriatrician advisor, who unfortunately couldn't be with us today, is that the geriatric approach is, you know, what matters most to the patient. Because at the end of the day, that's also going to be what motivates them. And in order to engage patients and get them to take the right daily actions, you know, they're the only ones that really have control over this. So if we can put it in the perspective of, this isn't, you aren't doing this because the doctor said, you know, that you should. You're doing this because of what's important to you. And that may be remaining independent, being able to live in my home, being able to do the activities that give me a lot of joy.
So somebody might be thinking to themselves, that sounds great, but how does this get paid for? How does this make financial sense, both for the, you know, the hospital, the clinician part of that equation, and then just overall in the system?
Great question. And that's where, you know, what we've tried to do here is to create an economic model that is available to everybody on Medicare. Because all our revenues are essentially Medicare reimbursed services. So there's, you know, there's, we have two streams of revenue. So one is we're actually a pharmacy, and we will deliver all the medications to the patient's home on a monthly basis, usually in dose time packaging, so that, because that helps a lot with adherence. And so we will do that, and that becomes about 90% of our revenue comes from those prescriptions. Now, the other source of revenue is the care that we provide through the nurse practitioners. And this actually starts with, when we work with physician practices, is doing the annual wellness visit. You know, this is a free benefit from Medicare. There's no copay associated with the annual wellness visit, but only about 20% of people in America actually get it. But this is where we start the conversation with the patient. And a lot of physicians don't necessarily provide these because they aren't, there's not a high level of reimbursement for it. And so they figure they can make more money in other ways. So we can help you know, the physician in terms of, we can do this ourselves because we use nurse practitioners and they're able to, you know, to provide that level of care, or we can do it in conjunction and just support the physician and then follow up on the, you know, the prevention plans that come out of that. So it starts with that, but then we use the chronic care management and remote patient monitoring to be able to have continual interaction with the patients, and, you know, depending on what the patient wants, you know, whether we're having, you know, short weekly calls or we have a longer monthly call, we really try to tailor it to them. But in that way, we can continue to help them define, you know, small steps that they can take actions on, they can make some progress, they can feel good about it, they can feel that they're in control of some of the things that are going on with their health, and in that way, really build to achieve bigger goals.
Is there an element at all over time around, you know, some digital things such as, you know, text and other tools that would prompt them? Or is it also a challenge because it's generally an older population, they're not necessarily digital natives, and so the phone call really is the anchor? And how do you think about that in terms of implementation and also keeping the cost of labor down?
Yeah. One, we will use the level of tech that the patient is comfortable with. So, you know, so we will match that. And if they prefer to communicate, you know, by text or by email or by phone, you know, we'll meet them where they are. Actually, 60% of people over 70 are regularly online at this point. It's really, you know, it's climbing rapidly. And but we see the tech part not as a replacement for the, you know, the human interaction. It enables two things. One, it enables our nurse practitioners to be able to bring the right information and the right practices to the patient at the right time. But we can also use, you know, that digital component for better education and to use as tools for engagement. And you know, we had an interesting discussion with someone who's in the space and talking about how, you know, we need, within healthcare, we need to be able to develop the same kind of gamification and addiction that online games have and social media has, and that's possible. We just have to do it, and some of the big companies are investing in it. When we look at the fact that Microsoft and Google and Apple are all putting, and Amazon are all putting big money into healthcare, this is a good thing, not because they're going to take over healthcare, because nobody dominates healthcare, but they're putting in the resources that are going to allow these kinds of tools to become more common and for us to embed in our regular interactions so that so that everybody wins from them.
That's great. I want to just get a snapshot of where the company is, what your needs are over the next year. And then I want to round that out by having Hayter offer just a little bit more from how this is going to benefit physicians and what types of physicians we're looking to pull into the business. But give us a sense of where are you now? Are you in the market? Are you, prepared, all that. And then maybe talk a little bit about the team and then give us a snapshot of the next 12 months.
All right, great. Yeah, well, we're in the market. We're working with our first physician practice. And we're focusing initially on independent primary care physician practices because for a couple of reasons. One, because they can make decisions much more quickly than a hospital system can. Also, because the benefits that we provide to the physician are felt more directly by independents, because we can help them generate additional revenue. When I talked about the chronic care management and remote patient monitoring, this actually gets billed through the physician practice, and we're a subcontractor, and so they take a percentage of that as well. So we can generate more revenue without any investment from the practice in systems or people. And also, we really help to take care of these complex patients, which are a burden on the physician and their staff. So we take a lot of that load off and provide their patients better care. So that's our initial target market, we're working with a primary care physician outside of Philadelphia right now, and it's going well. She's one of the initial things that that she said after we'd been talking for a while. She said, "Oh, you guys do prevention. We don't have time for that here," and that's the reality. Our healthcare system doesn't really pay for prevention, so most physicians don't have time to do what we're doing. So that's where we stand right now. Our team right now, we have myself, VP of Sales and Marketing. We have a VP of Operations that has just joined us. We have our nurse practitioner that's serving the patient. And then we have our medical director or clinical liaison, Glenn Zemmel, who's on board. And right now we're raising a $700,000 convertible note. This is the first outside money that we're bringing into the company. And we have a lead investor, Longevity Tech Fund. It's an age tech investor. We're in due diligence with... they don't mind if I say their name. It's Tech Coast Angels, have some other pitches lined up. So we're starting to get a lot of excitement, especially as we've begun to serve patients. So as we look towards the next year, right now it's a matter of getting a few physician practices up and going and a couple hundred patients. Make sure that we're treating the patients well, that the physicians are happy. And then scale up. So we see the convertible note taking us through first quarter next year. And what we want to do is at the end of the first quarter, raise a $5 million seed round to be able to scale and then open up our pharmacy as well. Because right now we aren't going to spend real early stage money on setting up the pharmacy side until we prove that we can work with the physicians and bring patients on board.
That makes a lot of sense. And Hayter, from that perspective, what do you think are the challenges that the company needs to address in terms of How do they appeal to the physician? How do they make this seamless for the physician? I mean, what are the, you know, from your perspective, what are the things that need to be solved over the next year?
I think the main thing is showing physicians what piece of the pie does Embrace fill in, and how is it adding value without adding a lot of sort of additional complexity or back and forth. The way I think about, you know, what Embrace can do for physicians or how it can help them, it's going to help expand their footprint. It can really be an implementation arm for the plan that's designed, developed in the clinic. So instead of that just being a one-off, that's a process that started and the baton is passed on to the coaching team of Embrace to really help sort of implement that after the patient leaves. I think it'll help patient satisfaction. I think patients love, most of our patients still love being cared for, being called after, and being sort of looked after. So I think that will definitely help the overall sort of satisfaction grade of the patient population. And I think that it's, what's smart is that it's using revenue that's currently being left on the table. So I think that is a really smart business strategy. And then ultimately, what I think it's going to do is it's going to improve patient outcomes. I think it's going to develop practices, and it's going to feed back to the physician and help with the issues around burnout and just feeling overstretched that I think many clinicians are struggling with. As far as which types of physicians, I think primarily our focus is on two groups. One is the primary care physician, and the other is a specialty physician. For starters, we're going to focus on cardiology. And I think they're going to have different needs, and that's what we're going to learn over this year. Is we already know, I think we've learned a lot about what will a primary care clinician want from Embrace and from our team that's going to help their patient population. I think the next step that we have to figure out is what is a cardiology practice going to need from Embrace, and those things might be different. And I think that's where having someone like myself as a heart failure specialist, many of our cardiology practices don't, heart failures change so much over such a short period of time that, you know, they really would, I think they would appreciate having a trusted source or voice that's helping guide or tailoring some of these plans that we're putting in place. But that's one of the things we're going to have to learn more about this next year.
Love it. I think that's very, very transparent. It's a good, smart thought process. In terms of, so it sounds to me like a couple things. Somebody who finds this an interesting, compelling space, yes, and as an interested in investing would be a candidate. They ought to reach out to you. And it sounds like the second would be physicians who are in those spaces, particularly primary care and potentially cardiology. If they've got an interest and say, yeah, this is a problem I see, I'd love to work with you guys and have this run with my practice. Sounds like that would be the other sort of sweet spot. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. That's why we're excited. And as far as getting you more involved in the Angel MD community is that, the investors, potential partners in terms of working together with physician practices, and also an important part of what we're doing is we're building out our physician advisors like Heather, who for each individual area where there are major chronic diseases, we want to have someone that is really sort of at the cutting edge and can help us bring the best evidence-based practices, through the primary care practice and directly into the home, so that, we aren't waiting, because, I'm sure you and your audience knows how long it takes from when things are proven, in trials and how long it takes for them to filter down where it becomes standard practice within, primary care. So we look at accelerating that by having an excellent team of physician advisors. So, the next ones that we're looking for are primarily in the area of a diabetologist who's an expert there on the respiratory side, because COPD, heart failure, diabetes and COPD, those are the big three.
Yeah.
And they put people in the hospital on a regular basis. And so we're looking for, other people that can, help us in that area as well.
It's great. Well, it's a great start to getting the story. Plenty more to come. We're going to be following you guys closely, and I'd love to have you back on the show after the first of the year and get an update. And as you know, we have other things that we do, including Pitch Club And there will be some pitch club sessions that will be relevant for what you're working on here in the new year. But is there anything that we haven't covered that you think would be germane, kind of as an initial introduction to the audience? Feel free to add it, either one of you.
Yeah, I guess one thing that, you know, Heather, let me give you a chance first, and then I'll wind up.
I think what I've learned is that, you know, I'll just go back to what I first said, is that, you know, being sick is hard for patients, and, you know, clinical care is getting harder and harder, even though we have all these, new innovations coming up. You know, we still have this big gap in getting it to patients, staying up to date with everything. And so I personally think that and some of what I'm sort of helping with this company was informed by my work at the VA, where I think we are fully tied into patient outcomes. It's the first true ACO, and especially as more of healthcare goes in that direction, I feel like what I'm learning in that space has been really, really informative in thinking about what the future of all of healthcare will look like. In some ways, has been accelerated by COVID as well, because there's such an emphasis now on remote monitoring. Patients don't want to come to clinic if they can avoid it. And so I think all the lessons we've learned during this pandemic, I think they're not going anywhere. If anything, I think this is a real opportunity to really take this to the next level.
Excellent. And the one other thing that we didn't touch on that I just wanted to mention briefly is the caregiver, the family caregiver aspect of older adult healthcare. Is that one, we see the opportunity to really, educate and involve the caregivers if they're willing, in a much more effective way, by communicating to them what is the plan and what can they do to help their loved one, implement the plan. As one of our team members has been caring for her now 94-year-old mother for the last 10 years. And just all the gaps that exist, you know, she has identified and said, this is what I want as a caregiver, to be able to make sure that my mom is getting the best care. And when we talk to, caregivers, about this, and they say, you mean I can have a nurse practitioner, looking after my, my mom or my dad, and keeping me updated on what's going on, and there may be no cost or just the copay of Medicare, where do I sign up? So, we're really trying to address the needs of all the stakeholders that really have a lot of impact on the system. And caregivers is one of the areas that, we need to, get them to be more effective, because they do put in a lot of time.
Well, I appreciate you both spending time today. This is a great space. I mean, for so many macro reasons, as you mentioned earlier, David, chronic disease is the biggest cost to our system. And it's all the readmissions and the challenges associated with that. And then you've got, of course, the metrics or the numbers around the baby boomer generation, that this is going to be a bigger and bigger challenge as our population's getting older. And so you guys are in a really, really great space. And I'm excited to really follow closely, and appreciate you guys spending time today. So thank you.
Thank you. Really enjoyed it.
See you again soon for the next episode of Innovation for Alpha. Make sure to go to Innovation for Alpha for access to prior episode links, show notes, and other valuable resources. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any investment decisions, please